Chapter 5. The Critical If. The problem is in our bodies, not in our brains. Hard as this may be to imagine, I'd like to suggest that the authorities, being all too human, just got it wrong. Virtually all of them, from von Norden in the 1900s to Newberg in the 1930s and 40s, and all those who followed. Although, as Malcolm Gladwell wrote in his 1998 New Yorker article about obesity and the obesity epidemic, considering how often the medical orthodoxy is mistaken, this should never be that hard to imagine. Gluttony and sloth and overeating and eating too much and sedentary behavior and physical inactivity and even overindulgence and ignorance or unresolved nervous tensions are easy answers for why so many of us get fat. But they're wrong. Footnote. A few of the very best obesity researchers knew that they had made effectively no progress in understanding obesity. Jules Hirsch of Rockefeller University, for instance, whom the Washington Post once described as having helped reframe the modern understanding of obesity, told me in 2002, shortly before he retired, that he considered his career an abject failure. After almost 40 years of research, he could no more explain how people get fat to begin with than he could explain how they can lose weight and keep it off once they do. They both remained mysteries to him. "I've been working on this for a hell of a long time," he said. "You'd think I would have gotten a little further along with it." 4 years later, Hirsch won a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Obesity Society. I'm surprised he didn't politely turn it down. They sound reasonable, so we too fall for them. But they are wrong. The authors of fad diet books have been trying to tell us so for decades. Some got it wrong, as I said, but many got it mostly right, because the mostly right solution worked. Why the authorities would make such an extraordinary mistake is more obvious in retrospect than it must have been at the time. The gist of it is that they thought about the problem, and still do, from a perspective that seems obvious if you're a lean person, and just happens to be more than a bit deceptive. Not only did they think it meaningful that they could starve people and emaciate them, but they could all too easily imagine fat men, like Shakespeare's Falstaff, with his gluttonous appetites for food and drink. "He hath eaten me out of house and home. He hath put all my substance into that fat belly of his," says Mistress Quickly about Falstaff in Henry IV, Part 2. And then assume that if Falstaff got fat for living immoderately, so must we all. Footnote. This thinking is so broadly accepted that even the Princeton philosopher and animal rights activist Peter Singer, writing with Jim Mason, uses it to argue that obesity is unethical. Aside from wasting food, and so the lives of animals, merely to accumulate body fat, he says, "If I choose to overeat and develop obesity-related health problems that require medical care, other people will probably have to bear some of the cost." But the if buried in that line of reasoning is an absolutely critical one. Even in Falstaff's case, we don't know if his gluttony caused his obesity or vice versa. Growing children will also tend to eat us out of house and home. I shudder to think how much my voracious 11-year-old will cost to feed as he's growing through puberty and adolescence. They do it because they're growing. So maybe adults with growing bellies do so for similar reasons. When my two sons were younger, we were fans of a series of humorous French children's books about young Nicolas, Nicolas in the original French versions, and his schoolmates. Nicolas has a friend named Alec, Alceste, who is fat, and he eats all the time. When Alec isn't eating, he's hungry. He is invariably pulling the remains of a croissant or a pastry from his pockets to eat between meals or even between snacks. He's all too ready to abandon the latest hijinks to ensure he makes it home promptly for dinner. But never in the books does the author, René Goscinny, opine on the possibility that Alec is fat because he's hungry and eats all the time. Perhaps he eats all the time because his body, unlike that of Nicholas and their numerous other lean friends, is singularly dedicated to accumulating fat. Perhaps his hunger is the result, not the cause, of a compulsory tendency to marked overweight and accumulation of fat. This is the point Astwood was making. Hunger is a response, not a cause. This is a fundamentally different way of looking at the problem of obesity and why we accumulate fat, and if we want to end the obesity epidemic and deal successfully with our own weight problems, we will have to take it seriously. We will have to learn a different way to eat as well, as the low-carb and keto diet doctors have been saying for a while now. In the mid-20th century, many of the leading figures in obesity research, like Julius Bauer at the University of Vienna and Russell Wilder of the Mayo Clinic, who actually studied and treated patients with obesity and who thought critically about the problem of human fatness without preconceptions, had come to accept, or at least seriously consider, the possibility that the seemingly obvious explanation, the conventional wisdom for the relationship among hunger, eating, and excess fat, that the first two cause the latter, gets the cause and effects backward. Rather, it's the drive to accumulate fat, rather than use it for fuel, that leads to the hunger and any seemingly excessive eating that occurs. They found this explanation compelling. These authorities had to struggle with it, though, because even they had been indoctrinated with the thinking about calories, the gluttony conviction. These authorities were legitimately curious about the subject they were studying. They asked questions about the process of fattening that might shed important light on the problem. This was how Astwood was thinking. Why, for instance, do men and women fatten differently and in very different places? Why do boys gain muscle and lose fat when they go through puberty, while girls gain fat and do so in specific places? Hips, buttocks, breasts. Why do women gain fat as they go through menopause, the experience Newberg and his followers wrote off to bonbons, bridge parties, and self-indulgence? Why do people get fat in some places, double chins, love handles, and not others? What about fatty tumors known as lipomas? Why do these benign fat deposits hold on to their fat even during starvation? These kinds of questions, they concluded, could be reasonably answered only by postulating hormonal and enzyme-related explanations for fat accumulation and obesity. Surely, how much people ate and exercised said nothing about these kinds of questions. If I have a pot belly, but my legs are skinny as bean poles, as with a significant proportion of men over a certain age in America, it seems clear that the amount of calories I eat and expend can tell me nothing about why. It seems hormones must play a key role in fat accumulation, as they do most other processes in the human body, and that a subtle shift of these hormonal mechanisms, which includes the enzymes and receptor molecules that can be thought of as the cellular antennae that receive and respond to these hormonal signals, whether globally or locally, could explain human obesity and these questions of localized fat accumulation. That in turn implies, as Astwood had suggested, that maybe all relevant questions about fat accumulation and obesity demand or require these kinds of hormonal and enzyme-related explanations. Ultimately, these pre-World War II physician researchers were thinking about the problem of excess fat from the perspective of first principles. Rather than asking why fat people eat so much or exercise so little without even knowing how much of either they do, as is the common state of affairs, they asked why these people accumulate so much fat, and why they accumulate it when and where they do. What regulates the process of fat accumulation? Why is fat trapped in our fat tissue, or around our organs, or in our livers, as is all too common these days, and dangerously so, and not used for fuel? Lean people burn fat for fuel. Why do those of us who are fat keep so much of it stored away? Why do some of us fatten easily, while others don't? Footnote. One key to making sense of the universe, i.e. doing good science, is knowing that the answers we get are dependent entirely on the questions we ask. So we'd better be asking the right questions before we conclude we got the right answers. By the early 1960s, when Keyes was hoping to shame fat men into thinking about their immoral behaviors, decades of very good scientists had already gone a long way toward answering these questions. This was what Astwood, the endocrinologist, considered relevant, and Keyes and his nutritional colleagues did not. Researchers, physiologists notably, and so not physicians or nutritionists, and certainly not psychiatrists or psychologists, had discovered that the storage of fat in fat cells and the liberation of that fat from storage and its use for fuel, oxidation in the lingo, wasn't in any way the simplistic process that was implied then and is implied still by the nutritional authorities. Columbia University's Hilda Bruch, who was the leading mid-20th century authority on childhood obesity, understood this and waxed indignant about it in a book she wrote in 1957 called The Importance of Overweight, which should still be required reading for anyone interested in understanding obesity. Bruch said that when she started to study obesity in children in the late 1930s, her medical colleagues would often ask her how she could possibly want to work with such dull and uninteresting cases. Her patients complained to her that their previous physicians had been uninterested in their situation. Or worse, quite often patients had recognized more than just lack of interest. Bruch wrote, they had felt offended by a condescending or sometimes frankly punitive and condemning attitude. Bruch herself was mystified, specifically, by the absence of interest by the researchers, those who had taken on the obligation of understanding obesity, in this process of fat accumulation. Looking at obesity without preconceived ideas, she wrote, one would assume that the main trend of research should be directed toward an examination of abnormalities of the fat metabolism, since by definition, excessive accumulation of fat is the underlying abnormality. It so happens that this is the area in which the least work has been done. She added, as long as it was not known how the body builds up and breaks down its fat deposit, the ignorance was glossed over by simply stating that food taken in excess of body needs was stored and deposited in the fat cells, the way potatoes are put into a bag. Obviously, this is not so. Bruch understood this for many reasons, but I'm going to suggest here that she did so largely because she was a working pediatrician. She not only studied obesity in children at Columbia, where she had opened the first pediatric obesity clinic in the United States, but she treated children who were obese, although with little success. These kids were not statistics to Bruch, numbers from a survey or answers from a questionnaire about what they might be eating and how much they might be exercising. They were her patients. She talked to them and interviewed them. She spent time with their parents and interviewed them. In doing so, she learned about both the compulsion to get fat and the compulsion to eat that might go with it. Bruch also followed her young patients as they grew into young adults. As Bruch told it, she was initially impressed by how easily these kids lost weight when she first gained their cooperation. But by 1957, she was more impressed with how quickly they gained the weight back. The tenacity with which they maintained their weight at an individually characteristic high level. So she concluded that overeating, though it is observed with great regularity, is not the cause of obesity. It is a symptom of an underlying disturbance. Food, of course, is essential for obesity, but so is it for the maintenance of life in general. The need for overeating and the changes in weight regulation and fat storage are the essential disturbances. By 1957, as Bruch wrote in her book, researchers were coming to understand many of the ways that hormones and their cellular targets, enzymes, work to orchestrate the use of fat in our bodies, how, where, and when it gets stored and is then liberated back into the bloodstream for its use as fuel. For those like Bruch and Astwood, who paid attention to this literature, it was all too easy to imagine how this complex biological system could somehow be out of balance in obesity, disturbed by some element of our modern world, such that we accumulate excessive amounts of fat in our fat cells, and maybe in and around our organs too, in a way that is little influenced by how much we eat. Researchers studying fat accumulation in animals would note how fat cells and the animals themselves could accumulate fat or immobilize it and burn it for fuel without regard to the nutritional state of the animal, as though how much or how frequently the animal ate was irrelevant to whether it was using up its fat stores or building them up. As Jean Mayer, the then Harvard nutritionist, would say about his laboratory mice, they turned food into fat even when half-starved. Why not humans, too? And if humans do, here's the obvious critical question. Can this fat storage problem be fixed? Can we change the way we eat so that it no longer happens and the bodies of people with obesity work like those of lean people?